time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
Okay, it's Talk Radio Europe, heading over now to the UK, to London, to speak to Richard Fitzwilliams, our film critic. Good afternoon, Richard. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm well indeed.
Good stuff. And didn't get a chance to speak to you post-Oscars, because you were with, and no doubt you and Alan had a love-in last Thursday talking about the Oscars. But just maybe in a nutshell, because I didn't get to hear that, what was your take generally on it all?
Well, generally, I thought that for all the troubles and the problems in the lead-up, that without a host, with the concentration on the films, and with some surprises and some very good speeches, it was an evening the Academy would be pleased with. And it's interesting that there's been a 12%+ increase in audience viewing, so I think that everybody is probably pretty relieved.
Yes, okay, so that's, it was a, I think I enjoyed watching the highlights, so I didn't stay up for it, but that certainly was, and
Olivia Colman for domestic consumption, I mean, and also her remarkable performance. I always thought it wrong that Glenn Close should win some form of, well, you could almost say a token Oscar, because she wasn't exceptional in The Wife. And, of course, we had Rami Malek's speech, we had Regina King's speech, the moments of emotion, and certainly a surprise at the end. So, I mean, it had its own sense of drama. You didn't really need a host, even though, of course, they'd made mistakes in the run-up. But the main thing is, you know, the show on the night, and it's still the greatest show on earth. Some of the fashions were pretty impressive, as they always are. But I have to say that with a huge set, and the fact that presenters were able to say a few words was rather nice, too. So it had a feel about it that just didn't seem defeatist or indeed disastrous, as it has once or twice in the past when we've had the wrong hosts as well.
Well, I was the other day watching a clip on television, and it was the Office Ricky Gervais comedy from years ago, going back a long time ago now. And in that clip was Olivia Colman, and it just reminded me where she's come from, really. You know, a bit of comedy sketches here and there, and there she is now, Queen of Hollywood.
It's extraordinary because she was in a film called Tyrannosaur, which was very powerful, and she was excellent in that. And she was also in The Night Manager, giving a remarkable performance in that. But there's no doubt that her profile's just suddenly been meteoric in its rise, and it really has been amazing. No, I felt it very successful, and then to the awards season. Sorry to see it end, but it ended well, and yes, there is a feeling against Netflix in Hollywood. Spielberg's speech, which attacked the fact that Netflix film was being shown, might have had quite an effect on, who knows, the proportional representation. It's a preferential system of voting that takes place. And this may be the view of a great many people, because, of course, we all want to see the cinema in the large screen.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Netflix element, Green Book, there were some critics who absolutely hated it, and it's not often that the day after you read in the couple of the papers here, the very worst film that could have won it and this sort of thing, because quite honestly, Green Book was an exceptionally good film with a very fine cast. It's not a new topic, good heavens no, but it was a new take on it. And yes, there were controversies, but then that's the case with a lot of films, many in many Oscars.
And Netflix aren't going anywhere, of course, and also the Netflix are losing their Disney side, because Disney are setting their own streaming service up. Apple are looking at doing it as well. It just seems to be that's not going to go anywhere. If anything, it's going to continue to grow that market. So it's going to be interesting.
Oh, it will. And also, I mean, there's no question Netflix had hope for a win, because, I mean, they spent $30 million on the billboards around Hollywood and on advertising. So, I mean, that was one shot at it. Roma would have been a very worthy winner, yeah. But it didn't win.
Okay, we move on then today, and we look on the basis of sex. And this, again, is something that's been, I suppose, covered a lot of times, this theme. But, again, it seems to be all the more around at the moment.
Yes, now, it's quite interesting that the film on the basis of sex, dealing with the way the career of Ruth Bader Ginsburg began, the American Supreme Court judge, and someone who, this is specifically concentrating on the landmark decision to break down some of the unfair barriers to women's equality under the law, but cleverly doing it, given that at the time this was, well, I mean, there's no question. It was sort of institutionally the case that you know, in the 40s and 50s, you had this extraordinary discrimination that was in law. And I have to say, as a biopic, we know or had a pretty good idea how it was going to end. And it's full of stereotypes, but it works extraordinarily well. We first meet Ruth as a first-year student at Harvard Law School, one of a very few the glass ceiling is firmly in place. Her husband Mark's also a student, but he falls ill with cancer. She transfers to Columbia. I can't find work as no one wants to hire a woman as a lawyer, and takes a job as an academic. She's a professor teaching about sex discrimination, and then here is the big find. This is a case where she can challenge the discrimination that's institutional in hundreds of laws in America by taking a case of a man, Charles Morris from Denver, who had to hire a nurse to help him care for his aging mother so he could continue to work. And he was denied a tax deduction because then it was only available for a woman. For the nursing care, the laws assumed that men would provide for the family, women would stay at home and looking after them and children. So it was this that male judges, it was thought, would favor male appellants. Do they? Well, no spoilers from me. I'm sure you can guess. She links up with a trades unionist, even with an activist, Dorothy Kenyon, who'd fought a case on Lusted before, played by the inimitable Kathy Bates, who yet again plays a tough woman with a heart. We've seen a lot of this, for example, before. We've seen the trades unionist in, it was reminded me of Made in Dagen in one or two scenes here, where he's basically sexist, but on the other hand comes out with a halo. The cancer, I have to say, vanishes pretty quickly. Not bad for only 5% getting through it. There are scenes in this that are very predictable, and it's one of the liberal biopics in the tradition of Trumbo, where you can predict a lot of what's going to happen, but that doesn't mean that Felicity Jones doesn't turn in a first-class performance as the famous Supreme Court Justice, who happily is still with us. And also, it's rather well made. The script is good. So in the court case, you are kept, you know, there's an element of drama, which there must be, but there is. It's an enjoyable film. It's well made. She's a very good actress, and yes, the material, it does rely a bit on stereotypes. I mean, that era did, but there's no question that it's an enjoyable film, and that's why it's done rather well with critics, because you recognize it's a good performance. You recognize a script that's pretty good. I mean, Armie Hammer plays her husband, and it's not obviously the main part is hers, but it's predictable, possibly enjoyable, definitely.
Yeah. Well, ratings out of 5, then, Richard, please.
Oh yes, definitely 3.5 for this. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Okay, this next one, I'm piqued my attention, and the way in which it's filmed, to be precise, Alita: Battle Angel.
Oh, Alita: Battle Angel is directed by Robert Rodriguez, and it is, this is most important, co-written and produced by James Cameron.
Ah, the Titanic.
Oh, indeed. It is a movie that's, again, unusual among these superhero Marvel type movies, where it's got a very complicated plot, but in brief, after a war called The Fall, Earth has been devastated. A cyborg scientist played by Dr. Dyson, Dyson played by the ever-delicious Christoph Waltz, is looking around a junkyard, because Iron City is, much of it is now a junkyard, and above it is the city of Zalem, in a sort of huge planet above the above Iron City. And he discovers a disembodied female cyborg with a fully intact human brain. He rebuilds it. He names it Alita after his deceased daughter. And, well, she meets her best friend, Hugo, played by Kian Johnson, and also comes into clashing with, this is the game of Motorball, rather like the Hunger Games, with the idea of thousands being distracted in the arena from the misery of their lives by a ruthless and vicious game. And the game is linked with certain powerful characters, including Vector, played by Mahershala Ali, no less, from Green Book, of course, a powerful Zalem scientist, and also we've got Jennifer Connelly as Dr. Charon, a master in cyborg engineering. I mean, one has to say the actual character of Alita is they use motion capture because it's a form of fusion with CGI. You create a hyper-real performance. You'll see her eyes look very strange. And there are constant scenes in this part of the film where characters are without body parts. Yeah. And so on. It's quite complicated in that respect. I mean, I have to say, it's rather colourful. It's a bit unusual. It's got some top-class actors. They don't have perhaps that much to do. But it's overall pretty good fun.
Yeah, it sounds it. I'm glad you gave it a good one because I want to watch that. Ratings out of 5 for that, Richard, please.
Oh, again, I think definitely 3. It is a bit long. 3D, yes. I've always wondered whether it's necessary to have movies in 3D. I don't think it adds that much apart from the obvious, but it didn't. I mean, it's interesting that Weta Digital, who did The Lord of the Rings, were responsible for some of the effects here.
Yeah.
And those who like the sort of film undoubtedly will find a lot to enjoy.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting one. It's just amazing where technology is going with film and how it's actually portraying where technology could possibly go in real life. Okay, let's. One of my favourite actors of all time, David Suchet.
How right you are, and may I just say that he is an amazing actor. I've followed his career since Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, where he played George Salieri in Amadeus, the David in Oliana. He was he's been in Robert Maxwell. There are a whole series of roles he's excelled in, and obviously everyone will remember him as Hercule Poirot. But when you see The Price, well, The Price is amazing. I have to say, I didn't know of this. I'd never read this play by Arthur Miller, and I didn't know the plot. It's how the Great Depression affects families. And David Suchet plays an 89-year-old who has come to value the furniture in a house which is being left, the furniture is being left divided possibly between two brothers. That is part of the plot as to what happens there. And it's a mesmerizing performance. He inhabits a role of somebody, it's fascinatingly ambiguous, because you're not quite sure whether this character is trying to swindle the brothers or not. And indeed, we learn a lot about him and about his private life, the loss of his daughter. But Suchet is just phenomenal. It really, really is a superlative performance, and he's been called the stage actor of our generation, and you can't get better than this sort of the play's got impact, really, really serious impact. And what is fascinating is also that listeners will remember Brendan Coyle, who plays one of the brothers of Mr. Bates in Downton Abbey. He puts in a good performance too. It's all very good.
Yeah.
He and also the actress playing his wife, Jonathan Church's production, though, will leave you drained, which is what All About Eve, which had all the hype in the world, and is based on the famous 1950 Joseph L. Mankiewicz film with Anne Baxter and, above all, Betty Davis, left me very cold, colourful, but lacked impact.
I'll tell you what, I really would love to go and see this. Where's it showing, actually, Richard, at the moment?
The press is at the Wyndham Theatre.
Yeah, okay. And also, you want to talk about the All About Eve. Much hyped, of course.
Well, what was interesting was the idea that you could make this film into a play, and also the way that you'd... what's interesting is the listeners may remember the plot. It's about a star-struck individual who doesn't appear to have any talent, hangs around the theatre door, becomes an assistant to the person she seems obsessed with, an established star, who is Margot Channing, and her name is Eve Harrington. When she becomes an assistant, well, she becomes so indispensable that she moves up to being an understudy. What happens is, of course, she supplants Margot, and you have an insight into a ruthless world. It's glamorous on the outside, and it couldn't be more killing inside. The original film was full of wit. The problem here is director Ivo van Hove puts about a third of the action on screen, a large screen above the stage. The characters are mic'd and filmed throughout, and as a result, it's a very discordant production. But the problem with the production is, if it's about stardom and you haven't got two stars, Gillian Anderson and Lily James, and they're really, really not that luminous, then its impact will be diluted, and that was the problem.
Oh, okay, so worth a watch or not?
Frankly, when the price is on, the answer's no.
Okay. Now, did you get an invite to Charles's birthday bash at all, Richard?
To whose?
Prince Charles had a bit of a birthday thing, didn't he?
Well, that, sorry, it happened to catch for a second. Now, what happened there was a question of just senior royals, certain well-known figures.
I did look for you, yes.
In Wales, the Queen decided to mark it not on the day, 50 years to the day, it would have been the 1st of July, just after the film The Royal Family, which was such a success at the time, and now you can't see, had been screened. And what was interesting, and what caught, was there was a lot of publicity about this, because it's a completely unique event, the investiture. It was the first major royal event screened for television, where you had a vast audience internationally, 19 million watching in Britain, and Lord Snowden as Constable of Carnarvon Castle. The event that dates back to 1301, where Edward I is supposed to have presented his eldest son to the people of Wales, and it was revived by Lloyd George in 1911 for political purposes. And here there was a perspex canopy, there was wonderful green grass, there was a very modern, almost space-age coronet. Looks rather ridiculous now. It was a great success, and it showed how the monarchy at the end of the 60s, when all the establishment institutions were shaking or laughing stocks, did brilliantly. But, of course, at the end of the 60s, 1968-69 also brought Rupert Murdoch, and that's totally another story. But there's no question it was a very, very successful event, 4,000 guests watching this this panoply. And the argument, of course, is that it put the spotlight on Wales, the Principality of Wales. So, in fact, when Charles becomes king, there may well be another sort of ceremony. It won't necessarily be like this, but there may be something that William will go through when he becomes Prince of Wales.
Ah, interesting. Right. Okay. So, as I say, I was invited, but I wasn't able to go. And I did look on the videos to see if you were there, Richard, but obviously you couldn't make it either. But there we are.
Well,
that
is many a call, but very, very few were chosen for this. This absolutely remarkable ceremony at the palace. But it's interesting, there were quite a lot there from Wales. There was a performance by a Welsh composer, the Orchestra of Wales, and this is just what is interesting is the connection. There is no, for example, on the Union Jack, there's no Welsh emblem, but equally there is this very special connection with the royal family, even if it does come from a conqueror in the 14th century.
Right, we'll leave it at that. We don't want to bring up the past. Richard, if anybody wants to find you online, how can they do that?
It's www.richardfitzwilliams.com and on Twitter at @rfitzwilliams.
And I forgot to ask you, of course, do forgive me, what are we looking at next week?
Oh, yes, next week. Next week, I think that we will be looking at Aftermath, film about the end of the Second World War, here in Knightley again, and also Julia Roberts, Ben is Back.
Lovely stuff. Thank you very much, Richard, as always. We'll speak soon.
It's a pleasure.